You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Greece's Prime Minister says that his country will not default on its debts, despite continuing unease in the world's financial markets over the country's economic future. I'll be joined by Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank here in London and George Brock, Professor of Journalism at City University in London, who will discuss that and many more of the day's stories from around the world. Also ahead... The leader of Germany's controversial Pegida movement quits, barely a week since she took up the post. We'll ask why. All that, and we'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and before the end of the show...
I hate gay men. Why are we even going? I hate them all.
They're
going
to be all like, oh, hi, oh, hi,
hi. We'll digest some of the latest gems from the small screen in our weekly television review. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all of that, here's Suzanne Chislett.
Monocle 24 News. Two Israeli soldiers have been killed and at least seven others injured in a missile strike by Hezbollah fighters in the north of Israel. The violence is the worst in the area since a 34-day war in 2006. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his military is acting swiftly against the threat.
At this moment, the IDF is responding to events in the north. To whoever is trying to challenge us on the northern border, I advise that they look and see what happened here, not far from Sderot, in the Gaza Strip. This past summer, Hamas sustained the most severe blow since its foundation, and the IDF is prepared to act powerfully on all fronts.
The UN has confirmed that one of its peacekeepers, a Spanish soldier, was killed in southern Lebanon as Israel responded to the attacks with airstrikes and artillery fire. The new Greek prime minister has promised radical change as his government moves to roll back key parts of Greece's international bailout. Alexis Tsipras insists he will not back down from the anti-austerity promises he made during the election campaign. The financial markets in Europe have reacted with a third day of losses. Nick Beecroft is chairman of Saxo Bank in London. He thinks the standoff with the EU over Greek debt will not be resolved quickly.
It is going to be a protracted negotiation, possibly taking many months. There are short-term liquidity issues which may be addressed, but in the big scheme of things, there seem to be some entrenched stances being taken left, right and centre. And listening to the new finance minister, although he is open to negotiation, obviously, he's making some pretty firm comments about the plight in which Greece finds itself.
Greece is understood to have objected to a planned extension of EU sanctions against Russia. The move will be discussed by EU foreign ministers at an extraordinary meeting on Thursday. The EU is expected to vote to continue the sanctions for another 9 months as it voices concerns about Moscow's ongoing role in the unrest in eastern Ukraine. Russia's deputy prime minister has insisted any new sanctions would be senseless and harmful. Addressing the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, British politician Jim Sheridan urged all sides to respect the ceasefire in eastern Ukraine and protect civilians.
There would be no conflict without Russian involvement, political, financial and military. And I have seen and heard enough to be convinced of this. The deaths, destruction and suffering in Ukraine will not stop until Russia respects Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity, including by withdrawing all military support from the separatists.
Dozens of people have been demonstrating outside the Japanese Prime Minister's office in Tokyo as efforts continue to try to secure the release of a Japanese journalist who's being held by Islamic State militants in Syria. One Japanese hostage has reportedly already been killed this week by the extremists who are demanding a ransom. The government in Jordan has said it is willing to free an Iraqi woman who was jailed for her role in a 2005 terror attack if IS releases one of its pilots, which it's also holding. The Afghan parliament has dealt a blow to President Ashraf Ghani's efforts to assemble a unity government, approving just 8 of his 25 cabinet nominees. Key positions of Minister of the Economy, Defence and Justice all remain vacant. The nomination of a central bank governor was also rejected by the lower house. The lack of leadership at ministries in Afghanistan is fueling instability at a time when the country is already struggling with a severe budget crisis, plummeting economic growth and a growing Taliban insurgency. Japan's leading independent budget airline Skymark has filed for bankruptcy. The low-cost carrier has blamed a weak yen and a dispute with Airbus about down payments for its jets for the move. The company's filed for protection from creditors, its chief executive officer has resigned, and it's announced it will delist from the Tokyo Stock Exchange at the start of March. It has liabilities of 71 billion yen, $603 million. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And the time here in London is 18.06, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank here in London and George Brock, Professor of Journalism at City University in London. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we begin today's show in Greece, where the country's new Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, told his cabinet today that his country would not default on its debts. We won't get into a mutually destructive clash, the Prime Minister said, but he added, we will not continue a policy of subjection. His comments came as turbulence continued in world financial markets over Greece's future in the Eurozone. Nina, it's been fascinating to watch us and other media outlets and indeed the world follow what's happening in Greece in such minutiae. We seem to have known every appointment to the cabinet, who does what their shirt preference is, whether they wear a tie or not. And I guess it's because this is seen as a bit of an example of what could happen elsewhere in Europe. And at the moment, it's still quite hard to read what's going to happen, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I don't think we'll have a better understanding of the compromise or the deal that will be struck between Greece and its EU creditors until February 16th. That's the date to watch out for, which is when the Eurogroup ministers will meet next. But there will be a lot of speculation until then. And as you correctly pointed out, with Syriza, we've been hearing a lot of conflicting things coming out. On one hand, they say, you know, the era of the Troika has ended and this is the end of austerity for Greece. And yet, on the other hand, they still say they want to be in the EU and they want to be a member of the Eurozone. Now, after the second Greek bailout, what's happened is a lot of Greek debt has been transferred to publicly backed institutions in the EU. And because of political and legal reasons, another Greek write-down of Greek debt looks very unlikely to happen. So there's limited room for compromise. So let's see what happens.
Just on that timetable, and before we bring in George, February 16th, will we have some clear indication on that day what's going to happen, or is that just a kind of a gathering of ministers?
No, that's when the Eurogroup ministers will meet next, and there will be some clear indication on what's happening. And the reason for this is because Syriza has limited time and limited money. Already, the Greek coffers at an all-time low of 2 billion euros, and they have debt maturing, which needs to be paid in the summer of 7 billion. So some kind of compromise needs to be struck very quickly, and they'll be moving towards that. It's very interesting to see how Tsipras has been saying that they won't default on their debt, so he's already moderating, it seems, some of his rhetoric that, you know, in the run-up to the election, he was being very, very consistent about saying, you know, Greece won't have to pay off these debts.
George, we wondered, after watching events today, whether he might have an eye on who might help bail him out if he gets into trouble. He's said that he's not going to back more kind of sanctions against Russia. He feels that's the wrong thing. Greece has traditionally been an ally of the Russians, has often looked east for trade and support and all sorts of things. Do you think that maybe he's thinking, actually, if the EU doesn't come to his rescue, there will be other characters in the wings who might want to help him?
Well, I certainly think he wants people in the EU to believe that. We'd have to wait and see how much the Russians were actually in a position to do. for him. But I think if you are anticipating a really very difficult negotiation, there are two things that, you know, negotiation instructors tell you is, one, throw your opponent off balance if you possibly can, and secondly, send out the biggest variety of messages you can dream up. So Tsipras is saying, well, you know, we want to keep talking, we want to stay in the euro, we don't want to default. In other words, concessionary, mild, benign type messages. His ministers, meanwhile, are saying, OK, we're stopping the privatization of the Port of Piraeus. We want to put the minimum wage up. We want to put back into public ownership one of the country's largest utilities. And we're going to rehire a lot of public servants. Now, both these things can't be true at the same time. So what they're trying to do is to kind of say to people, I mean, they're almost saying, we'd like to talk, and at the same time saying, we're going to engineer a crisis, which is really going to hold your feet to the fire. You're going to have to cut a slack because otherwise it's going to be disaster. It's not a bad negotiating tactic. Somebody quite sophisticated is advising him how to do this.
But do you feel that within the Eurozone, there are people who are nervous of the Greeks leaving, who are willing to make concessions? Because maybe it is all kind of just negotiation tactics, but what we're hearing from the Eurozone ministers is, the people that we represent in our own countries will not put up with this. We've already done what we can do. We're not going to be budging.
I think the northern European economic ministers and finance ministers in the Eurozone, Dutch, Finnish, as well as the Germans, for example, have very, very little room for manoeuvre. Their electorates didn't like these bailouts much, and are really not going to like being told that either they have to bail them out more or the conditions have been bent because Greece has decided to do it. So I think the possibility of Greece leaving the euro, is closer than people have tended to think in the last few days, because I think there is much less room for manoeuvre than people realise. The big division inside the finance ministries of those countries is, if Greece was to leave the euro, what then happens afterwards? In other words, do we make the euro as a whole safer by having Greece outside, or is it more dangerous? And there, I think, genuinely split.
Nina, we can't always judge what the truth is from watching the financial markets, but two interesting things. One, after the election of the government, actually the markets were pretty quiet. Today they've been a little bit more ruffled, but they seem to be ruffled just about Greece. They don't seem to be that bothered about the whole Eurozone project. And I wonder whether the markets have already kind of built in some kind of capacity or some belief that, Greece may go and we can cope with them.
Well, certainly the economic situation in Greece is much better than it was in 2012. So markets have factored that in. We've only seen the Greek bonds really dropping in the markets today. If Greece were to leave the Eurozone, the risk of contagion for the rest of the Eurozone is much lower than what it was in 2012. It would still take a hit. The Eurozone would still take a hit, but be much more painful for Greece than for the rest of the EU. Having said that, one must never underestimate the political will, which we've seen time and time again in the Eurozone crisis, to keep the single currency together. And even though Germany has been, very strong in saying, that they don't want to pay for more, they don't want to bail out Greece again, you'll hear time and time again politicians like Merkel coming out and saying that the euro must be kept together and they want to do everything to keep Greece in. But that is, of course, contingent upon structural reforms and no more bailouts.
George, it's all well and good us sitting here in London, a booming city, looking south and thinking, you need to get your house in order. But when you look at some of those figures, the minimum wage is currently 500 euros and they want to put it up to 750 euros. When you imagine, trying to survive on 125 euros, I think it's almost impossible to imagine those kind of the figures that people are living on. And many, many people obviously don't have a job at all. Do you feel that we may not like it, but actually the more, the wealthier northern nations in Europe are going to have to do something? It has become just untenable. If you keep people in poverty and with no hope of paying off their debts for 5 years, there gets a point where people, they start electing, governments you don't like.
No, but the question you've got to ask yourself if you're one of these wealthy nations is, in which direction do you go to help Greece, if you see what I mean? There are two possible ones. They can cut them more slack, bail them out further and so on, and that you'd do more of the same. But they can also say, actually, that's going to cause a widespread disaster, because in the end, we can't back the we can't find the political support to do this. So actually, Greece, you're going to have to find your own economic destiny. You want to make things easier, you're going to have to come out of the euro, effectively have a massive devaluation, and start again from there. So it's a question of what you think is the the greatest benefit to the greatest number of people. It's not automatically easy to say that just more bailouts are the way to do it.
But do you think that they're betting on the fact that actually within, say, a nation like the UK, where we have a general election just 100 days away, that there's a good chance that the opposition party, the socialists here in this country, the Labour Party could win? And they're not on a press message, but they are saying we need less austerity, we need to ease up on this. Mm. Do you think that they're thinking actually they could connect with a constituency in lots of the northern countries as well, who think that actually while some people have done okay, there's still lots of people all around Europe are feeling this isn't right, this kind of austerity measures?
I don't. If you're hinting that you think there is a leftward shift going on in European countries, there are two shifts. I mean, certainly there are anti-austerity politicians who are doing better, as in Greece, maybe a little bit for the Labour Party in Britain. But there are also lots and lots of, particularly in Northern Europe, lots of movements going in the other direction, saying, yes, we will provide a certain amount of transfer. Yes, we will provide a certain amount of help, but it only goes so far.
Although lots of those right-wing parties, I guess, Nina, even like when you see the populist parties, they're not very pro EU. But what's your kind of, you've given us a good little timetable of what's going to happen over the coming weeks. What do you feel are the kind of key things that the Greeks need to do to kind of win over the rest of Europe and to kind of keep their reforms funded? Because, they're not a Venezuela, who funded their kind of what seemed to be impossible reforms with a resources boom. They don't have a resources boom. It's very difficult to see how they fund this for a very long time.
Well, I think the key thing to remember is that going into the negotiations, there's two very polarized sides. However, I think the most likely compromise is going to be some kind of extend and pretend deal whereby Greece gets a little bit more easing on their repayment schedule. I do not see their debt being written off, however, not only because it means that Eurozone taxpayers are liable, which would be politically impossible in some of the countries holding a lot of the Greek debt now, but also because of the fear of what that could trigger. Already in Spain, we're seeing the rise of Podemos, which is also an anti-austerity party, founded only last year, polling at 25%. Spain has their elections later this year, and they've got their eye very much on what happens in Greece and what happens with Syriza. So you can imagine the rest of the countries in the Eurozone aren't too keen to have to, write off the debt of Spain, and also countries like France, which is doing economically terrible. Front National in France is watching very closely what's happening in Greece. So all the powers that be, I think, are going to be very, very stringent in making sure that there is no more debt write-off.
Well, it's a long time since so many journalists were watching what was unfolding in Athens, and we certainly join them in gazing that direction too. Well, we're going to take a short break now, but when we come back, we'll be looking at the Pegida movement in Germany and also what you do about hostage negotiations.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our bureau chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York bureau chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank here in London, and George Brock, Professor of Journalism at City University in London too. Now, the Jordanian Foreign Ministry earlier today stated that it would release the alleged would-be suicide bomber in its custody if Islamic State fighters return one of its fighter pilots who crash-landed in northern Syria late last year. The paying of ransoms by governments to release hostages has been a key topic of debate recently, but how effective is the swapping of prisoners in securing a hostage's release? interesting moves. Obviously, this is also tied up with the Japanese hostage as well. And Japan seems to be keen that there's a double deal done here. Nina, what's fascinating, first of all, is that, you know, impossible to negotiate with IS. You know, just a few days ago, they were asking for $200 million, and now it's fallen back to the release of one woman in Jordanian captivity. Do you feel that there can be any hope of negotiating with them, or is this just a moving target?
Well, I think that it's really interesting to see how terrorist organizations have changed their funding structure so that hostage taking is now one of the biggest funding sources for these type of terrorist organizations. So when we hear about things like, some of the IS hostages being executed, a lot of other hostages, mostly European hostages, are often released and, you know, this public type execution isn't done because by some estimates, they think about $125 million dollars have been paid out for this type of hostage exchange. And there have been some instances where it's been successful, where they released prisoners in exchange for hostages. But I think it's a kind of slippery catch-22 situation, because if you negotiate with terrorists and you give them money in exchange for releasing hostages, or whether you release prisoners, you know, ultimately you're still funding the aims of the organization. I think it's a very tricky one.
George, it is fascinating, as I was hinting there. It seems that almost the IS have kind of dropped the bar to a level where a deal can be done for the first time. You know, it's not that complicated for the Jordanians to release one person. Before, they've been asking for, you know, troops to be pulled out, for, you know, people, for governments to kind of change course, and that isn't going to happen. But suddenly there is something. I wonder what's changed in their psyche. Do you think there is a bit of a shift here happening?
I'm not sure. I think they think Jordan is the weak link here. They would love to strip coalition allies away from the airstrikes against IS. Okay, probably the non-American coalition allies in the airstrikes are not that important. It's mostly American fighter bombers that are doing it. But symbolically, and an awful lot of hostage-taking and terrorism is about symbolism and theatre, you know, to strip away the allies and persuade Jordan that it isn't a very good idea to do it would be something of a coup, and they could start, you know, they could imply that they would intimidate other countries that are making life difficult for them. What happens if they start kidnapping Turks, for example? They've got a lot of issues with Turkey for obvious reasons we've discussed before on this programme. So I think that Jordan is, I don't want to sound unsympathetic to the Japanese hostage, but I think Japan is somewhat a sideshow here. The really important target here is Jordan getting them to release prisoners. And Jordan holds quite a lot of prisoners, probably they're quite interested in. Maybe they want more.
Nina, it's a fascinating region to watch at the moment. But one of the strange things is how the priority has changed so quickly. When we were in the studio not many months ago, all the talk was about, could Kobani be defended? Could this town be held? Could the Kurds retake it? Well, it was quietly retaken by the Kurds this week. It wasn't really at the top line of news anyway. It was mentioned in newspapers. But these hostage debates have kind of moved the story away. So in a way, I wonder if this is also a strange PR effect for IS, because, you know, nobody's talking about Kobani. It's a huge failure for them, but it's not really being discussed in the way that it would have been if it happened, you know, a few months ago, because of these hostage stories, which are in the news all the time.
Well, certainly, and I think they've done very well in terms of marketing their cause. You know, they've been very sophisticated in terms of their digital presence, and, you know, they even have IS even has an online publication which is available in English. So they've been very sophisticated in their propaganda campaign. And they know that if you have an hostage and, you know, you have public execution videos, that's going to get a lot of media attention. So, yeah, absolutely. They've picked that one battle well, I think. But as I already mentioned, I think it's a big source of economic revenue for them as well.
Well, finally today, it was announced a few hours ago that the leader of Pegida, the controversial anti-Islam group in Germany, has resigned barely a week since she took up the position. Katrin Ertl took over from Lutz Bachmann, who resigned last week after a photograph of him posing as Hitler appeared online. Now, when we watch this story, it's, you know, she says that she felt that her former leader was still too involved with the party. The party says it's because, you know, she's been the target of a hate campaign. But George, is this, you know, is this a story in itself? Because what concerns me is, you know, that yes, of course, you kind of get rid of the leaders of these parties, but there is something happening in Germany that has to be recognised. There is this right-wing anti-migration movement, and whether we get, you know, we lose a few leaders here and there, it doesn't answer the question of why it's happening on the ground.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't answer what's happening on the ground, but I think it probably tells us something about what's going to happen in the future, because one of the things that's been happening with Pegida is something that happens with every sudden political movement that arises from a strong but inchoate set of feelings. Pegida unites people, or united people in the marches, who were calm, law-abiding people who don't feel that their country has enough control over immigration and would like a better debate about it at one end of the scale, right down the other end of the scale through various variations to neo-Nazis. And what happens with movements like that is as soon as they become prominent, they're in the eye of the news and the eye of the storm, and they begin to break up because the people who've put them together can't agree about all of the tactics and strategy they're suddenly called on to do. All they've just done being united is the feeling that they have in common, and feeling isn't a strategy. It's not how you decide all the difficult questions. So the fact that there are people falling out of the top of Pegida is not at all surprising. It's what frequently happens to these kind of movements. But there are some it is both a question, which obviously Germany isn't discussing well enough, but you can also see at the same time why the German political class dislikes this kind of discussion so much, because what comes to the surface is something very, very unpleasant. There are signs in Pegida marches which say in German, Wahrheit statt Lügepresse. And that means, translated means, truth instead of lying press. Now, that slogan was used by Hitler first in 1922. It was used frequently by Goebbels. It was part of the kind of Nazi party. The establishment doesn't, you know, lies about us, doesn't tell the truth about us, and so on. So there are some very, very nasty echoes in this. And I think it is extremely difficult for people from the outside to lecture Germany about how they should do this debate. It's much, much easier to debate immigration everywhere else. It really is.
Nina, a Pegida, a spent force, do you think?
Well, I think George hit the nail on the head there. I think that, you know, it's emblematic of something, a disease in society. But I'm German, and I just like to say that no matter how many Pegida protesters there were a lot more counter-protesters in Germany demonstrating against the Pegida protesters. But I think the interesting question here is, can any political party tap into that discontented demographic? And there is one willing to kind of do this, and that's AfD, Alternative für Deutschland, which is Germany's anti-Euro party. They've also attracted a whole range of people who are discontent on immigration or Eurozone policies, etc. But until now, they've kept away from the immigration debate because it can get quite nasty. However, interestingly, some of the deputy leaders of this party now, including Alexander Gauland, have come out very strongly in favor of Pegida, saying that this is a discussion that needs to be had. And he actually even said today, to a German paper today, that he thinks that there should be no more immigration of Middle Eastern people to Germany. So it is a question that is concerning Germany. And now some political leaders, including the Vice Chancellor of Germany, has actually had talks with some of the Pegida supporters. And I think that's very important that some of the mainstream parties actually address some of those concerns. Because if they don't, which is what we see in countries such as Sweden, then the anti-immigration parties can become very strong. And in fact, in Sweden, only a few months ago, the Swedish Democrats, which is the anti-immigration party, brought down the newly elected government. So this issue of immigration is not something that we only see here in the UK. We see it in Germany, we see it in Sweden, we see it in France. It's a much bigger question that's encompassing all of Europe.
George, just a few seconds left, but do you feel the same, that it's a conversation that should have been started earlier and in a more moderate way, so you didn't see the rise of these parties?
Well, yes, obviously, but it is perpetually difficult, because I don't think the problems in most of these countries were, and there are many countries in which this feeling is rising, I don't think the problem is immigration itself. I think it's people's sense that they don't control it. I think they're confident that they can integrate outsiders. The problem is politicians have got to be able to reassure them about control while at the same time not shutting people out or doing something cruel or unpleasant.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today. That was Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank here in London, and George Brock, Professor of Journalism at City University in London too. Thank you both for joining us here on Midori House. Well, there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House, but more of that in a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, in the next half hour, we're going to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and we're going to ask why a UK heritage body wants some of London's key office blocks to be protected for future generations. But before that, here's Suzanne Chislett.
Thank you, Andrew. Two Israeli soldiers and a UN peacekeeper have been killed and at least seven others injured in a missile strike and gunfights between Hezbollah fighters in the north of Israel and Israeli forces. The violence is the worst in the area since a 34-day war began in 2006. The new Greek prime minister has promised radical change as his government moves to roll back key parts of Greece's international bailout. Alexis Tsipras insists he will not back down from the anti-austerity promises that he made during the election campaign. European Union foreign ministers will meet on Thursday to discuss increasing sanctions against Russia over its role in Ukraine. The sanctions are expected to be extended for another 9 months. The US is also considering following suit. And the Afghan parliament has been dealt a blow to President Ashraf Ghani's efforts to assemble a unity government. It's approved just 8 of his 25 cabinet nominees. Key positions of Minister of the Economy, Defence and Justice all remain vacant. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. It's now 18:32 here in London, and you listen to Midori House on Monocle 24. And the time now is, well, it's time to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we're going to head to Spain, where our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, is waiting. Liam, thank you very much for joining us. First of all, we're going to be looking at a bit of a local kind of story of politics and intrigue and a jail sentence too.
Yes, so Luis Bárcenas has walked from jail. He's posted 200,000 euros bail. He's actually been in jail for 19 months. And those who aren't familiar with Luis Bárcenas, he was the ex-treasurer of the ruling PP party. And he was found to have a Swiss bank account with onwards and upwards of 40 million euros stashed away. And then it came out that he was actually in charge of a secondary accounting system for the ruling party. And basically dealing out kickbacks and second salaries to high-ranking officials. So he was put in jail 19 months ago, and ever since then he's been dripping out details via his lawyer and to the media, and it hasn't fared very well for the ruling PP party, who are now worried that he's going to come out swinging because they didn't really defend him when he was locked up. So it's not looking good for the ruling PP party in an election year.
So I understand bail has been posted. So had he served his time now then?
No. He's actually facing something like, I think it came out in the papers last week, that he was looking at maybe 70 years jail time for his offences. So it's a very ugly situation for Prime Minister Rajoy, because it seems as if Luis Bárcenas, there's so much proof and evidence that has come out that he's basically looking like he wants to take the ship down with him. And there was some curious words that he uttered as he left prison. He said, basically, I have nothing to say to Mariano Rajoy except that I followed his advice and I'm thankful to him. And Luis, talking about himself in third person, has truly been strong. So he was referring to a text message that came out in the papers after he was locked up, apparently from the Prime Minister, saying that, Luis, don't worry, it'll be okay, stay strong. So some very key words there upon his his release, basically trying to link himself with the Prime Minister and show that the Prime Minister, who has denied any involvement, is actually very close to him.
And I understand quickly that some 170 people are facing charges alongside him.
Yeah, 170 people are facing charges, 60 of which are actually PP party officials. So you were talking about Podemos earlier in the show, and this is helping the Podemos' chances in the elections, because this trial is going to basically start very soon, and it's in an election year, and this anti-corruption, anti-political caste message that Podemos has is just going to be reinforced with all the action that we're going to see in the courts.
Now, it's quite easy to lose things these days, but 400 years ago, someone in Spain managed to lose the bones of Miguel de Cervantes, who's, of course, the author of Don Quixote. But now someone's found them.
Well, yes, apparently they found them. The headlines just in the last...
There they are.
In the last few days, we found Miguel de Cervantes. I'm just wondering why it took them so long to start looking. It's been 400 years. They knew that apparently he was in a specific building, just where I used to live, actually. I lived a block away from there, and it was well known that he was buried there, but no one actually knew where. So a team of forensic scientists have gone in to this old cloisters and actually found a coffin marked MC, and they'll be analysing his remains for a few anatomical clues. He was 68 when he died. He only had 6 teeth left, apparently. I don't know where that was written down. And he had a very deformed backbone. But so the forensic...
Well, it's not going to be too hard to tell whether it's him or not, then, is it?
Well, in the papers, apparently he was actually found with... there was quite a few different remains in the coffin. Apparently they didn't have enough space, so they were doubling up in those coffins. So the head forensic scientist said it's actually not 100% certain yet. We'll just have to wait and see. So I think the papers got ahead of themselves declaring that he'd been found.
And MC Hammer's still with us, so it can't be that MC. So I'm sure they found the right guy. Now, finally, a little bit more seriously, there's another story, which is... another story of tombs, in a way, the Valley of the Fallen.
Yeah, I have a bit of a deathly theme today. I apologise for that. But the Valley of the Fallen, if listeners aren't familiar with it, is actually celebrating its 75th anniversary this year. It's where the ex-dictator Francisco Franco is buried, along with thousands of other people who died in the Civil War. It's just outside of Madrid. And it's a bit of a political hot potato, because successive governments haven't really known what to do with it. And it's kind of an oddity, because you don't really see countries like Germany or especially not Germany and Italy really having massive monuments, not celebrating their ex-dictators, but this monument, there's a 150 meter tall cross. It's on sits atop a massive outcrop of granite, and it's quite impressive to see. And basically it's very controversial, because there were actually annual funerals held for the ex-dictator right up until 2007. So that was actually banned by former Prime Minister Zapatero, and there was a bit of outcry from the PP party, the Conservative Party, about that, which is quite eyebrow-raising. But basically, it's falling into disrepair at the moment, and it basically reflects the political inaction. No one really knows what to do with it.
Well, Liam, great as ever to speak to you. That's Monocle's Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous. And thank you to him. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we're going to find out why a UK heritage body wants to protect some of London's most noteworthy office spaces. Stay with us.
Miami was all washed up, but then a brand new breed of art galleries and a boatload of art collections sailed in. Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound finds out how this big bad city turned into a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed art town.
There's warm weather art here, sure, and flesh on show. Why not? And there's the saleable, big, bright and bold. But there's good art for sale too. Things that mean things. This city's become a magnet.
Son of a Beach, the Miami art scene. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Well, Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, many architecture enthusiasts would have woken up to some rather good news today. English Heritage, which is the national body headed with categorising and ultimately ensuring the protection of architecturally and historically important buildings, announced that 14 additional buildings would be listed or protected as Grade 2. Why is this important? Well, this shortlist of buildings are all from the post-war period and are all office or commercial buildings. And we're going to hear from English Heritage in just a minute. But first, let's hear the reaction from the 20th Century Society, a campaigning body. Monocle's David Pleasant spoke to its director, Catherine Croft, a little earlier.
I definitely think the economy picking up has had a big impact. And, you know, we're talking about buildings on the whole that are right in the middle of city centres and where pressures for redevelopment are the highest. And also quite a lot of the buildings of this period were, you know, they were quite tall, but buildings nowadays are going up twice as high, so that the land values that you can realise by demolishing and redeveloping are huge.
Maybe let's kind of talk in more broad terms about buildings from this era. Of course, there's 14 that are selected today. There are many more. Maybe tell us about your organisation, what campaigns are keeping you occupied, what kinds of buildings you'd like to see added to this list.
Yeah, I mean, this list is... it's a great list, but there are, you know, obviously there are lots of buildings I'd love to have seen on it that didn't make the grade. In particular, there are two buildings by John Maiden, who was a commercial architect in Birmingham, which have been turned down. They've been assessed as part of the process and turned down, including the NatWest Tower. So major bank headquarters right in the middle of Birmingham, which is really great, craggy sculptural building. And it has fabulous doors by a sculptor called Bill Mitchell, whose work I really admire. And that's the building that I would have just loved to have seen maybe made into a residential conversion. It would have been, you know, it could have been amazing, a flat conversion. But that looks very much as though it will now be demolished.
Was there a kind of favourite that slipped through that you were surprised by, or you were particularly relieved by, if you look at that list of 14?
I really like the building that was built for the Crédit Lyonnais in the city, on Cannon Street, which has this amazing arched facade, which is all done in fibreglass, basically. And I was worried about that one because it's not by a sort of academic, respected architect who is known as a sort of fine art architect. It's by a commercial firm. And I think it's always harder to get those buildings that are straight commercial buildings rather than those with a, you know, respectable knighted architect behind them.
So it's a sort of kind of familiar friend to a lot of people who might be walking past, but as you say, it has no kind of great name for itself, as it were.
Yeah, and it's a fun building rather than a sort of intellectually serious building. I think that's, you know, a lot of the buildings on this list are by Arup Associates, who are a fantastic firm of architects, but they are really serious architects who took the tenets of modernism very, very thoroughly, and their architecture is very rigorous, and it's about beautiful detailing. They're kind of like the BMW of architecture, or whereas this is some flash, slightly cheap sports car, maybe.
It's lovable all the same. It's a fantastic corner building that's really quite distinctive. You wouldn't really think it's London. It might kind of be Beirut or Paris or something.
Well, and it's for a French bank. You know, it's a bit of kind of continental flair come to London.
Well, that was Catherine Croft, director of the 20th Century Society. Well, listening to that was Roger Bowdler, who's the designation director of English Heritage. And congratulations. A good day. It's really interesting to see these buildings being listed. Why do you feel it was important to get them this designation?
These buildings are really commercially sensitive. They're owned by investment companies. They are very valuable investments. Those people need to know where they stand about what's going to happen to their buildings. So for us to give them the certainty that that one is an exceptionally interesting building and should ideally be given to future generations to enjoy as well, they want to know as well. And the great thing is these are wonderful buildings and they're all working really well.
But without naming names, but the pace of change in London is unbelievable. And we're seeing so many office buildings turned into residential. Did you feel that there was a kind of an impetus to act now? And I presume that some of these people are keen to see their investments developed in other ways. So is there a bit of a pushback from some of the owners, do you think?
Some people are wary about listing because, let's be honest, it does reduce your options for change. To demolish a listed building is quite a process. It doesn't happen very often. So we've got to admit we are reducing people's freedom. But that said, owners, occupants, they want good buildings. They want to be there. So owners are proud of the best of the architecture that they're lucky enough to own and to manage. So they wanted to know. We gave them the clarity. There were some delicate discussions at first, but I think now there's a lot of relief and a lot of celebration at the buildings that people are working in the capital.
Now, you've chosen some remarkable buildings, but I was interested in something you said earlier today, that you felt that these buildings are also important, not just for how they look, but how they kind of chimed with how work changed and how we viewed work. They're part of our social history as well.
They are. I mean, melancholy to relate, we spend an awful lot of time of our waking hours. I was in my office before it got light today. I left when it was way after dark. That's where we live part of the life. Isn't that a sad thing to say? So of course they matter. So the way we work, highly important. Doesn't like history or heritage just deal with castles and abbeys? Oh no. It's about how we all live. And that's what the sort of history people are more and more interested in.
I was also fascinated that I think that the reception to the list was actually quite warm. In the past, you know, 10 years ago or something, often when contemporary buildings were listed, there was a bit of kind of like, really, is it worth it? A bit of harumphing around it. But there feels that there's been a bit of a change, that perhaps there's a generation that grew up in the 60s and 70s who look back at those buildings with some affection now. Do you think that we're actually beginning to appreciate the odd bit of brutalism? You know, the Credit Lyonnais building is actually a beauty, I think, and it's, you know, it's not a concrete monster. We're understanding there was a richness back in that architecture.
I think two things. You're absolutely right. I think we are warmer about what we now regard as the fairly contemporary period piece, the swinging 60s, the groovy 70s. You know, we used to think it would dismiss it as brown, rather dreary, a bit flared. Now, actually, we're seeing the better aspects of it. The other point I'd make is that so much has come down. The ones that we're left with, and they are being taken down very, very quickly, tend to be the ones that have lasted. They're the distinguished ones, and they're the ones we want to be concentrating on and celebrating.
And I'm sure you're fond of all 14 of them, but was there a particular one that kind of stood out for you as, you know, important, socially important for architectural reasons? Was there something that was a favourite of yours on that list?
We've talked a lot about Crédit Lyonnais, and that's a corker. I think the really significant one is possibly the Norman Foster building at Cosham, the IBM building, glass box, very finely detailed. It's meant to be an adaptable building. It has been adapted. It was so influential. I think that you're really seeing the roots of very important practices. Identity emerged from that one.
And just finally, Catherine Croft was saying that she felt 14 was amazing. She would obviously like you to list, you know, 114. Will we see more of these buildings coming onto the list, you feel?
Well, she would say that, wouldn't she? You'll see.
I think she was being supportive.
Catherine's always supportive. We'll see some more, but we need to move on to other areas. Universities are changing. We've got to go and look at university buildings, schools, public sculpture is something we're really keen to do. Housing. Public housing is being demolished all the time. There are so many areas for us to do. So we think we've had a pretty good go for the moment at commercial buildings, and we'll move on to some other things next.
So when you're talking about social housing, you're meaning, yeah, I know that there was a big discussion about the Park Hill estate in Sheffield. There have been discussions about other bits of, you know, I guess, again, there's a changing debate, isn't there? Because many people look back at the 60s and 70s, you know, high-rise living, and then it was discounted for 20 or 30 years because so much of it was done in a way that was cheap. But even the good stuff got wrapped in with that. And do you feel, again, we're beginning to be able to sift what was the good and what was the bad and what should be kept? That, you know, there's a more finely tuned appreciation of what's out there.
There's definitely a zeitgeist that has been to look at public housing of the 60s, 50s and 60s, and really admire it. And at its best, it was really well conceived, generously planned, built on a human scale, but some of it worked better than other bits. And there has been enormous change in the way they've been managed. The right to buy thing has completely altered the coherent management of places. Some buildings work really, really well. You know, Trellick Tower, pretty hip building. Others, much less so. It's a very patchy story, and it's still a contested history. And when we're going to list it, we've got to be really, really sure when we make our recommendations to government, we've identified the best ones, and on balance, it's a positive outcome. It's still quite hard to do that.
Well, Roger, thank you very much for coming in to see us. That's Roger Bowdler, who's the Designation Director of English Heritage. And you can hear more on that story on next week's Section D show on Monocle 2, which airs on Tuesdays at 1900 hours London time. Thank you, Roger.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and it's time now for our daily arts review. And today we talk television, and I'm joined by Alice Vincent, a cultural commentator at the Daily Telegraph newspaper here in the UK. And we're going to start with a slightly racy show, and we're going to play a clip to begin with. This is Cucumber.
I hate gay men. Why are we even going? I hate them all.
They're
going
to be all like,
oh, hi.
You marry me?
No.
I mean, why on earth are we doing that?
Henry!
Where the hell are you staying?
Can I stay?
They scare me a bit, man.
Help me, please.
No!
Do you want to know what's really going on? I'm going to tell you all about your Uncle Henry.
Does this mean you're a virgin?
I'm not talking about it, okay?
You are amazing.
C'est moi.
Well, Alice, this has been quite a controversial show in the run-up. It's from Russell T. Davies, and it's got a couple of spin-offs. There's an online story. There's another kind of spin-off story from this. It launched on Channel 4 here last week. What did you make of it?
I actually found it quite sad, which I don't think most people are finding it. It is funny. It's quite rude. It's not as rude as everyone's saying. Maybe I've got a high tolerance for it. The presentation of gay men in middle age going through the kind of midlife crises that a lot of middle-aged people go through, and how relationships work and don't work at that time. And I found that quite sad, actually.
Well, I guess the premise is, it's not surprising in a kind of a straight comedy drama, in that you would have a couple where one of the guys was attracted to younger people because he felt that he was going through a midlife crisis. There was a tension around, there's no children involved. There's what's the point of being together? All these elements. But I watched it as well. I found it, I don't know why, I found it very kind of uncomfortable. It made me feel really, angsty. And and I'm not sure. I'm not sure if I'm meant to find it funny. I can't quite find the characters funny. I just feel kind of, it just feels, oh my gosh, please sort this out.
I think what's interesting about it is that obviously Russell T. Davies in the 90s, he broke ground with Queer as Folk, and now he's dealing with an older kind of community of gay men. But what he's looking at are a lot of modern issues. So Grindr wasn't around in the 90s, the discussion of potential prostate cancer, that wasn't around in quite such a way 20 years ago. So I think that's what's interesting about it. But it's interesting you say that, that discomfort and that awkwardness remains.
And I guess that was the same, the other interesting discussion, right? I think that was the same discussion almost with Queer as Folk. What was interesting was, a non-gay audience, what do we make of this kind of crazy world? And for a gay audience, I think many of them felt with Queer as Folk, and I think feel the same with Cucumber. It's like, oh my God, is this representative of who we are? They still feel that there should be a positive image projected in a way on TV of what gay people are like, and it's a mixed bag image, just like any other drama. And some of the characters come off better than others. It's funny who the market is and how it kind of sits, I think.
Mm.
Well, anyway, that's enough of Cucumbers. Now another drama which we're going through all of the sexual options here. This is Transparent.
Listen, I need to talk to you about something. There's a big change going on. And, oh God. I love you kids, I love you kids, I love you kids. I love you kids, I love you kids.
It is cancer,
Daddy,
oh my
are
God.
You dying?
Just
You're
tell
right.
us if you're dying.
I knew it was cancer.
Daddy, are you dying?
I don't think he has cancer.
Dad, just tell us how he does.
He looks good.
He looks good.
Thank you.
Wait, it doesn't matter how he looks.
Remember Jill Goldberg? Yeah. She had a melanoma for 3 years. They couldn't see it. Then, boom, she's dead.
Jill Goldberg is dead?
Yeah. No, and if daddy had cancer, you'd have the kind of way you look at. But the one, well, all your friends died of it. What was the thing? Prostate. Right. Prostate cancer. Right. That's the one that you'd probably have. Right.
Right. Super sick.
Oh, my
God. Yeah.
You
never
nothing
know.
Nothing to be joked about.
Then that's beside
how many of your friends?
Oh! Stop it!
Well, yeah, about to reveal what the secret is there. And we can guess, though, from the name. It's called Transparent, or Transparent, how you wish to pronounce it. And it's about, you know, a trans parent.
Right.
Now, it won a Golden Globe. Mm-hmm. It's made by Amazon. There's so many interesting things about mm-hmm. how it's being marketed. First of all, the content. You've seen some of it. What do you make of it?
I think it's brilliant. In converse to Cucumber, I found it very, very funny. And it is a comedy. It was nominated in the comedy category at the Golden Globes. But I found it very, dark, funny. And it's got a brilliant cast. And I just think it's different and it's sensitively treated.
Well, Jeffrey Tambor is amazing. But what's interesting is also how it's being offered to us. So it's made by Amazon and they just put them all out in one go. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of the Netflix. It's that Netflix's nearest rival, which it never used to be until it won a Golden Globe, and now Transparent has been put out available for free. So it's even more of an attractive proposition.
Now, the final program we're going to look at today is Better Call Saul.
I was a jerk, so I will pay you what I owe you, plus interest. You just let me come through.
I suggest you find parking somewhere else.
Somewhere else? As in where somewhere else?
Not my concern.
This is your job, so by definition, it's your concern. So pump out the ticket and open the stupid gate already, please. Hey, I'm gonna...
I don't think you want to be doing that.
Oh, yeah? What are you gonna do? You got a poop-filled diaper in there? You gonna throw it at me? Are you gonna gum me to death, huh, geezer?
Now, that's Better Call Saul, which is a spin-off from Breaking Bad. So all those people who didn't know what to do with their lives after Breaking Bad actually finished, they've got something.
They have. And what's even more exciting about Better Call Saul, if you are a Breaking Bad fan, is that it's both a sequel and a prequel. So it starts 10 years before Breaking Bad ended, 2002. And it's from Peter Gould and Vince Gilligan, who created Breaking Bad. So expect lots of those kind of Mexican Albuquerque big skies and the rutting figures, as we heard in that clip. But you're also going to find out what happens after the end of Breaking Bad.
Could you enjoy this series if you hadn't seen Breaking Bad?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the creators are very definite that they want it to stand on its own merit. So I think, yeah, you will. I mean...
And the other thing about this is the depth of involvement people had with Breaking Bad. It was amazing the number of people I met who hadn't got into it for a while, and then they'd suddenly started watching it, and then they were up all night. They were watching it back to back and back. Does this have that same kind of glue?
I think so. I mean, Netflix are the distributor for it, and although they're not releasing it in one big hit because they're more savvy than that. I think when it does become available as a whole, people are going to be binging on it, yeah.
So, Transparent, drugs, prequel to drugs, we're talking about drugs and gay life. It's quite interesting, the pitch process these days when someone goes in to sell a TV program. And they still managed to sell something about needlework as well, in the mix as well. So there's lots of interesting things to watch here on British and American TV as well. Thank you so much for coming in and running through everything. That's, of course, Alice Vincent, who's a cultural commentator at the Daily Telegraph newspaper here in London. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guest, Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank here in London, and George Brock, professor of journalism at City University in London. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by David Pleasant and Henry Sheridan Rees, and our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Next, after the headlines, it's The Entrepreneurs with Danny Giacopelli. Then at 2200 hours, it's time for The Monocle Daily, and today it's brought to you by Andrew Mueller and Nancy Durham. This show, well, it's going to be back at the same time tomorrow, which is, of course, 1800 hours. But for me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say goodbye and thank you very much for listening.